Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
John Locke, a British philosopher from 1632 to 1704, covering the time of Newton and a few other famous people, Leibniz, Kant, or leading up to Kant, I suppose. A very interesting philosopher. So he really looked into the fact, linking with philosophy as the mechanism of thought, and how you could apply a bit of inductive theory from Bacon to loosen up some of the grip of the scholastic tradition that have, I suppose, I would say, plagued philosophy. So we've looked at his essay, which is in four books, and I struggle to remember. It's the Nature of Knowledge, or the Nature of Ideas, Knowledge as Ideas, and then whether you are born with it or you have to develop it, whether it's language, and then the Quality of Ideas is the four overall books. And that's something I'll have to get right on top of. I suppose I read it today, so it's fairly reasonable I should read it over a couple of days to see if I can get it into my head. But we're on to part four of this internet encyclopedia. I like that, internet encyclopedia. It's obviously something you really couldn't quote too much, but it's condensed in a very readable form. And I'll say the person who wrote it, is from Iowa State University, and his name is Patrick Connolly. G'day Patrick, if you ever listen to this. Political philosophy. Locke lived during a very eventful time in English politics. You betcha. The Civil War, Interregnum, Restoration, the Exclusion Crisis, and the Glorious Revolution all happened during his lifetime. Well, you know, a bit of the Civil War. I don't understand I don't know about the Exclusion Crisis or the Glorious Revolution. I'd have to really get into that. So this is one of your fundamental things, understanding philosophy and not understanding the history. It means that I'm probably an ignorant person, or I am an ignorant person. For much of his life, Locke held administrative positions in government and paid very careful attention to contemporary debates in political theory. So it is perhaps unsurprising that he wrote a number of works on political issues. In this field, Locke is best known for his arguments in favour of religious toleration and limited government. Today, these ideas are commonplace and widely accepted, but in Locke's time, they were highly innovative, even radical. A. The Two Treatises. Similar to the essay, Two Treatises. Locke's Two Treatises of Government were published in 1689, about 15 years before his death. It was originally thought they were intended to defend the Glorious Revolution and William's seizure of the throne. We now know, however, they were in fact composed much earlier. Nonetheless, they do lay out a view of government amenable to many of William's supporters. The first treatise is now primarily a historical interest. It takes the form of a detailed critique of the work called Patrica by Robert Filmer. Filmer had argued, in a rather unsophisticated way, in favour of divine right of monarchy. In his view, the power of the kings ultimately originated from the dominion of God gave to Adam, which had passed down an unbroken chain through the ages. Locke disputes this picture on a number of historical grounds. Perhaps most importantly, Locke also distinguishes between a number of different types of dominion or governing power, which Filmer had run together. After clearing some ground in the first treatise, Locke offers a positive view of the nature of government in much better known second treatise. Part of Locke's strategy in this work was to offer different accounts of the origin of government, while Filmer had suggested that humans had always been subject to political power, Locke argues for the opposite. According to him, humans were initially in a state of nature. The state of nature was apolitical in the sense there was no governance, for each individual retained all of his own or her natural rights. People possessed these natural rights, including the right to attempt to preserve one's life, to seize unclaimed valuables, and so forth, because they were given by God to all his people. What? The right to seize unclaimed valuables and so forth? Oh, my Godfather. Oh, gee, that shudders down my spine. The state of nature was inherently unstable. Individuals would be under constant threat of physical harm, and they would be unable to pursue any goals that required stability and widespread cooperation with other humans. My Godfather. Locke's claim that government arose in this context. Individuals, seeing the benefits which could be gained, decided to relinquish some of their rights to a central authority while retaining other rights. This took the form of a contract. Nicholas de Casa, you need consent for government. Consent for representation. In agreement for relinquishing certain rights, individuals would receive protection from physical harm, security of their possessions, and ability to interact and cooperate with other humans in a stable environment. So according to this view, governments were instituted by citizens of those governments. This has a number of very important consequences. On this view, rulers have an obligation to be responsive to the needs and desires of their citizens. Further, in establishing a government, the citizens had relinquished some, but not all, their original rights. So no ruler could claim absolute power over all elements of a citizen's life. This carved out important room for certain individual rights or liberties. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, a government which failed to adequately protect the rights and interests of its citizens, or a government which attempted to overstep its authority, would be failing to perform a task for which it was created. As such, the citizens would be entitled to revolt and replace the existing government with one that could be suitably carry out the duties of ensuring peace and civil order while respecting individual rights. So Locke was able to use the account of natural rights and a government created through contract to accomplish a number of important tasks. He could use it to show why individuals retain certain rights even when they are subject to a government. He could also use it to show why despotic governments which attempted to unduly infringe on the rights of the citizens were bad. And he could use it to show that citizens had a right to revolt in instances where the government failed in certain ways. These are powerful ideas which remain important even today. That is really interesting. For more, see the article Political Philosophy. Okay. B. Property. Locke's second treatise on government contains an influential account on the nature of private property. According to Locke, God gave humans the world and its contents to have in common. The world was to provide humans with what was necessary for continuation and enjoyment of life. But Locke also believed it was possible for individuals to appropriate individual parts for the world and justly hold them for their own exclusive use. Put differently, Locke believed that we have a right to acquire private property. Locke's claim is that we acquire property by mixing our labour with some natural resource. For example, if I discover some grapes growing on a vine, through my labour in picking and collecting these grapes, I acquire ownership right over them. Oh, God. If I find an empty field and then use my labour to plough the field, then plant and raise crops, I will be the proper owner of those crops. If I drop down trees in an unclaimed forest and use the wood in a fashion to table, then table will be mine. Locke places two important limitations in the way that property can be acquired by mixing labour with natural resources. First, there is what has to become known as the waste proviso. One must not take so much property that some of it goes to waste. I should not appropriate gallons and gallons of grapes if I'm only able to eat a few and the rest end up rotting. If the goods of the earth were given to us by God, it would be inappropriate to allow some of his goods to go to waste. Second, there is enough and as good proviso. This says that in appropriating resources, I'm required to leave enough and as good for others to appropriate. If the world were left to us in common by God, it would be wrong for me to appropriate more than my fair share and fail to leave sufficient resources for others. Oh dear, this makes me sad reading this. After currency is introduced and after governments are established, the nature of property obviously changes a great deal. Using metal, which can be made into coins and which does not perish in the way of foodstuff, as other goods do, individuals are able to accumulate much more wealth than would be possible otherwise. So the proviso concerning waste seems to drop away. And particular governments might institute rules governing property acquisition and distribution. Locke was aware of this and devoted a great deal of thought to the nature of property and proper distribution of property within the Commonwealth. His writing on economics, monetary policy, charity and social welfare systems are evidence of this. But Locke's view on property inside the Commonwealth have received far less attention than his views of the original acquisition of property in the state of nature. Oh, God, that just sounds disaster. There's no one to police. C. Toleration. Locke had been systematically thinking about issues relating to religious toleration since his early years in London and even through, though he only published his Epistola de Toleranta, the letter concerning toleration, in 1689. He had finished writing it several years before. The question of whether or not a state should attempt to prescribe one particular religion within the state, what means it might be used to do so, and what correct attitude should be towards those who resist the conversion to the official state religion, had been essential to European politics ever since the Protestant Reformation. Locke's time in England, France and the Netherlands had given him experience of three different approaches to these questions. These experiences had convinced him that, for the most part, individuals should be allowed to practice their religion without interference from the state. Indeed, part of the impetus for the publication of Locke's letter concerning toleration came from Louis XVI's revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which took away the already limited rights of Protestants in France and exposed them to state prosecution. It is possible to see Locke's arguments in favour of toleration as relating both in epistemological views of the essay and the political views of the two treaties. Relating to Locke's epistemological views, recall from above that Locke thought the scope of human knowledge was extremely restricted. We might not be particularly good at determining what is the correct religion is. There's no reason to think that those holding political power will be any better at discovering the true religion than anybody else. So they should not attempt to enforce their views on others. Instead, each individual should be allowed to pursue true beliefs as best they are available. Little harm results from allowing others to have their own religious beliefs, you would think, but obviously other people disagree. Indeed, it might be beneficial to allow plurality of beliefs because one group might end up with the correct beliefs and win over the other side. Relating to Locke's political views, as expressed in the two treaties, Locke enjoys toleration on the grounds that enforcement of religious conformity is outside the proper scope of government. People consent to governance for the purpose of establishing social order and rule of law. Governments should refrain from enforcing religious conformity because in doing so unnecessarily irrelevant for these ends. Indeed, attempting to enforce conformity may positively harm these ends and it is likely to lead to resistance from members of the prohibited religions. Locke also suggested that government should tolerate the religious beliefs of individual citizens because enforcing religious belief is actually impossible. I also agree. Acceptance of certain religion is an inward act, a function of one's beliefs, but governments are designed to control people's actions. So governments are, in many ways, ill-equipped to enforce the adoption of a political religion because people have an almost perfect control of their own thoughts. While Locke's view on toleration were very progressive for the time, and while his views do have an affinity with our contemporary consensus on the value of religious toleration, it's important to recognise that Locke did place some severe limits on toleration. He did not think that we should tolerate the intolerant, those who seek to forcibly impose their religious views on others. Similarly, any religious group who poses a threat to political stability and public safety should not be tolerated. Importantly, Locke included Roman Catholics in this group. Dear. In his view, Catholics had a fundamental allegiance to Pope, a foreign prince who did not recognise the sovereignty of English law. This made Catholics a threat to civil government and peace. Finally, Locke also believed that atheists should not be tolerated because they did not believe they would be rewarded or punished for their actions in the afterlife. Locke did not think they could be trusted to behave morally and maintain their contractual obligations. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that absolutely amazing? How amazingly hypocritical in the world. Not him, but, you know, the world. Theology. We have already seen the essay, in the essay, Locke developed an account of belief according to faith and belief according to reason. That's interesting. I wish I could get that in my head. Faith is something, a reason is something you can observe. Faith is what you believe. Faith. Recall that an agent believes according to reason when she discovers something, though through the use of her natural facilities. She believes according to faith when she takes something as truth because she understands it to be the message of God. Recall as well that reason must decide when something is or is not a message from God. The goal of Locke's reasonableness of Christianity is to show that it is reasonable to be a Christian. Locke argues that we do have sufficient reason to think that the central truths of Christianity were communicated to us by God through the messenger Jesus of Nazareth. For Locke's project to succeed, he needed to show that Jesus provided his original followers with sufficient evidence that he was the legitimate messenger of God. Given that numerous individuals in history have purported to be recipients of divine revelation, there must be something special about it which sets Jesus apart. Locke offers two considerations in this regard. First, it is that Jesus fulfilled a number of historical predictions concerning the coming of the Messiah. The second is that Jesus performed a number of miracles, which attests to the fact of his special relationship with God. Like a travelling salesman, God. Locke also claims that we have sufficient reason to believe that the miracles actually occurred on the basis of testimonies of those who witnessed them firsthand and reliable chain of reporting from Jesus' time to our own. This argument leads Locke into a discussion of the types and value of testimony, which many philosophers have found to be interesting in its own right. Which is sort of like the whole basis of it. It's, people can say, it's sort of like the manual of an old TRS-80 computer, that's no good, you know, it's of no value, and the computer's gone, but you can sort of see a lot from the structure. One striking feature of the reasonableness of Christianity is the requirement for salvation that Locke endorses. Disputes about the precise beliefs were necessary for salvation and eternal life in heaven were at the core of much religious disagreement in Locke's time. Different denominations and sects claimed that they, and only they, had the correct beliefs. Locke, by contrast, argued that to be a true Christian and worthy of salvation, an individual only need to believe in one simple truth, that Jesus is the Messiah. Of course, Locke believed that there were many other important truths in the Bible, but he thought these other truths, especially those contained in the epistles rather than gospels, would be difficult to interpret and could lead to disputes and disagreements. The core tenet of Christianity, however, is that Jesus' Messiah was a mandatory belief. In making the requirements of Christian faith and salvation so minimal, Locke was part of a growing faction in the Church of England. These individuals, often known as the Latitudinarians, were deliberately attempting to construct a more ascetic Christianity. I wonder if that's Irene, the principle. I wonder what Irene can see if I can remember Irene. With the goal of avoiding the conflict and controversy of previous internecine fights had produced. I wonder if that's Empress Irene. I really love it. If that was true, that would be a beautiful word. So Locke was hardly alone in attempting to find core Christian commitments which were free of sectarian theological baggage, but Locke was still somewhat radical. Few theologians had made the requirements for Christian faith quite so minimal. Education. Locke was regarded by many in his time as an expert on educational matters. He taught many students at Oxford and also served as a private tutor. Locke's correspondence showed that he was constantly asked to recommend tutors and offer pedagogical advice. Locke's expertise led to his most important work on the subject, Some Thoughts Concerning Education. The work had its origin in a series of letters Locke wrote to Edward Clarke offering advice on the education of Clarke's children and his first published in 1693. view on education were, for the time, quite forward-looking. Classical language usually learned through tedious exercises involving rote memorization and corporal punishment were two prominent features of 17th century English education systems. Locke saw little use in either. Instead, he emphasized the importance of teaching practical knowledge. He recognized children learn best when they are engaged with the subject matter. Locke also foreshadowed some contemporary pedagogical views by suggesting that children should be allowed some self-direction in their courses of studies and should have an ability to pursue their interests. Locke believed it was important to take great care in educating the young. He recognized that habits, prejudices formed in youth would be very hard to break later in life. Thus, much of some thoughts concerning education focuses on the morality and the best ways to inculcate virtue in industry. Locke rejected the authoritarian approach. Instead, he favored methods that would help the children to understand the difference between right and wrong and to cultivate moral sense of their own. Locke's influence. The essay was quickly recognized as an important philosophical contribution to both its admirers and critics. Before long, it had been incorporated into the curriculum of Oxford and Cambridge, and its translation to both Latin and French garnered its audience on the continent as well. The two treatises were also recognized as important contributions to the political thought. While the work had some success in England, among those favorably disposed to the Glorious Revolution, I had never heard of this before. Its primary impact was abroad. During the American Revolution, and to a lesser extent during the French Revolution, Locke's views were often appealed to by those seeking to establish a more representative forms of government. Related to the last point, Locke came to be seen alongside his friend Newton as the embodiment of the Enlightenment values and ideals. Newton's science would lay the bare the workings of nature and lead the importance of technological advances. Lockean philosophy would lay bare the workings of men's minds and lead to important reforms in law and government. Voltaire played an instrumental role in shaping this legacy for Locke and worked hard to publicize Locke's views on reason, toleration and limited government. Locke also came to be seen as an inspiration for the deist movement, whatever they are. Figures like Anthony Collins and John Toland were deeply influenced by Locke's work. So what is the deist movement? Locke is often recognized as the founder of British empiricism, and it is true that Locke laid the foundation for much of English language philosophy.
Yes, huh? No, I will.
Locke is often recognized as the founder of British empiricism, and it's true that Locke laid the foundation for much of English language philosophy in the 18th and 19th century. But those who followed in his footsteps were not unquestioning followers. George Berkeley, David Hume, Thomas Reid, and all others offered serious critiques. In recent decades, readers have attempted to offer more charitable reconstructions of Locke's philosophy. Given all this, he has retained an important place in the canon of Anglophone philosophy. Okay, and the author is Patrick Connolly, and he's from Iowa State University, United States of America, and I won't read his email over, so I'll get this out soon. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.